And welcome to Sip for Speaks, the podcast where we explore the latest issues in public finance management affecting people, place and planet. I'm your host, Jess, and today we're diving into an important topic for public sector organisations worldwide, corruption prevention and corruption risk management, CRM. We'll be exploring why a prevention-first approach is critical to fighting corruption and how CRM helps public bodies identify and manage risks before they take root. We'll also hear more about the launch of the second pilot of CIPFA's Corruption Prevention Programme in Mauritius. Joining me today to discuss these themes are Khalid Hamid, CIPFA's Director of International, and Daniela Soto Valdivia, a Crime Prevention and Criminal Justice Officer from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. Khalid, let's get straight into this. Why is corruption prevention so important for public sector organisations? And why is corruption prevention a priority theme for CIPFA?
Thank you, Jess. And it's a very interesting topic, as you say. And the reason why it's so important predominantly is because fundamentally, whether it's democracy that's been threatened or whether we have the rise of populism around the world, there is a fundamental need to ensure that the public believe in their governments and they believe in their public sector and their public officials. And one of the most common erosions of that trust is corruption. If you go into most countries and you get a cab somewhere and you talk to the cab drivers, they will often refer to corruption as being one of the worst aspects of why they don't believe in their government, which also then erodes the tax base. People don't want to pay tax if money's not going to get there. And that therefore affects service delivery and the fact that people and those most vulnerable in society often are the ones who are the most affected. And as we were working towards having to do more with less, as the world is suffering from inflation effects and we've got things like climate emergencies coming, all of this, it can't be done unless you have a coherent and a belief in your country systems. And as I say, it's just the erosion. So CIPFA, what we're saying is ourselves is that there's no point in having perfect processes, systems, laws, everything else, if at the bottom, at the end of the day, that everything's leaked out the system through people doing wrongdoings. And that also has a longer term effect, which I'm sure Daniela will touch on in different ways as well, which is corruption also distorts how things are. So what happens is that then you baked into the system is the ways in which to work around the system, and that complicates everything. So just to do something simple as a citizen, get an ID card or get a driving license, becomes a nightmare. And that then people refer that to that as red tape, when actually you need regulation, but what you're doing is you're undermining that regulation. So if we want to build public finance, we want to build public management, and we want to build public confidence, you've got to start with this. And often it's never seen as part of the area and agenda of public finance. And we want to put it on the map and put it front and center of the map because of that.
Absolutely. And Daniela, how does corruption risk management fit into the UNODC's broader anti-corruption work?
Thank you for the question, Jess. And yes, as Khalid was saying, corruption really diminishes trust. And as in UNODC, we are the guardians of the United Nations Convention Against Corruption. I don't know if many of you are familiar, but it is a very comprehensive document that tries to guide countries into what activities they could implement, what action they can take in order not only to prevent corruption, but also to criminalize certain acts as acts of corruption, but also talks about international cooperation, asset recovery. It's very comprehensive. But we have a specific chapter that focuses on prevention, on corruption prevention. And within this chapter, it talks about the importance of countries adopting risk management systems. And here it is where the corruption risk management processes come into place, because in UNODC, we try to foster for countries to implement these processes so that it can open the door for other anti-corruption tools. For example, an institution, maybe it's easier to understand it with examples, if an institution identifies a corruption risk, let's say the issue, there are irregularities in the issuing of fishing licenses. And then they decide that one of the mitigation strategies, for example, could be to implement some sort of regulation that allows for the public to know how the decision-making processes work in the institution. So that already calls for more transparency, or they might decide to implement some sort of process that allows, or some sort of mechanism that allows for the public to report acts of corruption. That already also increases accountability in the organization. So this whole process, the beauty of the process is that it opens the door for the adoption of other anti-corruption tools, which are already also many of them part of the UNCAC and what is suggested to the countries and endorsed by the countries to be implemented to strengthen the organizations. So in this sense, the whole corruption risk management process allows to have more efficient institutions, and in the long term then translate into generating more trust for the public, what Khalid was saying. And also it allows to have some tangible change. It takes some time, yes, but some tangible change that allows the citizens to change this perception of corruption. Because sometimes countries take a lot of action. We have very nice laws in many countries and others, but the perception of corruption in the public is still there because those decisions taken at the higher level are not taken to the citizen. And this process does that. It does not only allow for nice papers to be drafted and implemented, but also for real change to happen and really get to the citizens.
That's really valuable and interesting to hear, particularly those examples. I think it really shows the real world impact on citizens, as you say. And Khalid, what are the key elements of corruption risk management that help public sector organisations spot and manage corruption risks early?
There's a variety of areas, and all of them are important because, again, when you're looking at a process like corruption, you've got to attack it systematically and comprehensively, because if you don't, the weakest link will cause vulnerability and will continue the issue. So the first element of any management process, as we say, and currently hearing the refrain about, you know, the fish rots from the head, it's the leadership issue and having that start point of real buy-in from those who have the power of the organization and how that power dynamic works through the organization to get the organizational buy-in through the leadership. The second element is the organizational practice and commitment and resources towards corruption prevention, because one of the things is there's rhetoric, there's people speaking about things, but are there actual commitment of resources to the process? And that commitment of resources, again, what you'll see often is indirectly there'll be internal controls, there'll be internal audit, there'll be other governance and risk processes, but directly for anti-corruption and corruption prevention, is there actually resources committed? And this is an interesting issue which I often challenge the professional audit and accounting industry on, is when you put the word corruption in front of risk, you start broadening out who you're talking about, because it becomes other stakeholders outside of the internal control system of the organization. There's a shadow economy, there's other aspects that you can bring into it that make it a little bit more broader. So it's a second area of the commitment of resources. The third one is having people on an operational level who can actually implement the corruption risk assessment and undertake a mechanism for making sure that there is organizational processes that are committed to this and dedicated to it. And that's got to be integrated into the organization's risk management process as well. And then finally, having a community, creating a community across the public sector where corruption prevention is seen and discussed, because again, it's one of those things. I mean, in the UK, for example, we're even scared to use word corruption. You talk about sleaze, and it's this idea that we need to actually bring it out. And again, as Daniela said, one of the biggest, as they say, disinfectants is the transparency, and the actual calling out and talking about this. So it's got to become part of the dialogue that we use in our everyday work and in our everyday circumstances. So that's all of that has to happen. If any of that's not there, it's not necessarily sustainable.
Yeah, it's absolutely just as much a cultural language changing perception shift as it is these processes. And Daniela, what benefits are you seeing from focusing on prevention in public sector anti-corruption strategies?
I think there are many benefits to focusing on prevention, but I do believe that the corruption risk management has three key benefits that distinguish it from other anti-corruption tools. The first one is that the corruption risk management, as Khalid was mentioning, really leads to more sustainable change because it helps institutions to, over time, become more efficient and manage their resources more efficiently. For instance, this is as a personal experience, in one institution we were working with in one country, through the process, they realized that there might be some misuse of seized woods or obsolete woods, the woods that were not already like being in use. Nobody knew what was happening to them. And all of this happened because during the discussion groups, they realized that there were some firearms somewhere and they didn't even know what to do with them or how many were there and what to do with them in the long run. And if they could do something with them or not, or if they were supposed to send it to another organization. So all of these topics that I think officials never took the time to sit down and said, okay, where are our corruption risk? What is happening? And this is the beauty of the process. It gives the public officials the opportunity to sit down and to analyze, okay, where might things go wrong? And of course, where is the political will to do something about it? So then they identify these specific areas where there's political will to address the corruption risks that are there. And then here, for example, in this specific process, they developed a regulation or like an internal regulation that allowed them to establish the standard operating procedures of what to do when they seized woods and also what to do when woods would become obsolete. They were not of use anymore for anyone. So what would happen then? Because of course they still have some value, but nobody knew what to do with them. So this is a small example of how they identified a possible place. Of course, with all the issues we have around trafficking of firearms and others, it is also a sensitive topic and it's important that something is done there. So then they identified this topic, then they developed some regulations. And now, of course, then together with the regulation comes the dissemination of the information to all the public officials in the organization to know what to do with these resources and how to act on these situations. So that already shows that it can make the organization more efficient. But it also, something that Khalid, another benefit of the whole process, as Khalid was mentioning, is that it really allows public officials to openly discuss about corruption risks. So we move away from corruption being a taboo topic and only focusing on cases of corruption, okay, talking only about, okay, in the news, I read that this person went to jail and received so many years as a punishment. So we move away from that to looking at corruption risks. And the difference with corruption risks is that the act of corruption has not happened, but there's a window, a possibility that someone might misuse an opportunity or a process that is there to benefit himself or herself. So within these discussions or the processes, we've seen that public officials are not scared about talking about corruption risks because it's not an investigation. And this is something very important to understand, that to address corruption, we do not only need to put people in jail, but we also need to work on how to avoid that situation where we have to send people to jail and investigate what they have done, but rather focusing on how to make organizations stronger. And I think the third benefit of the process, and it's connected to this, is that the process really allows us to protect resources. This meaning that there are some cases of corruption where, yes, it is good that we send people to jail, that they are punished and others, but there are some cases where corruption really plays a huge role, let's say in all the topics related to climate change or to environmental protection. There's no going back. Even if we send all the corrupt public officials to jail, that are involved in, I don't know, a case or where it was allowed to illegally deforest 5 hectares of primary forest. There's no way that even if we send them like their whole life to jail, we will be able to recover that primary forest in our lifespan. Therefore, it is so important that especially these institutions that are mandated to protect natural resources or any resources undertake the corruption risk management. So at the end of the day, we protect these precious natural resources. There's no other way to support this fight of fighting deforestation or mitigating or adapting to climate change if we do not prevent corruption from happening. So this is, I think, the third benefit of the process.
And it's clear that prevention is a really powerful element of corruption risk management, particularly for sustaining change in high-risk environments. And Khalid, you've mentioned leadership buy-in as an essential factor for corruption risk management. What role do you feel that leadership buy-in plays in driving these sort of real lasting change in anti-corruption efforts?
The way in which you can see the impact of leadership is if you flip it on its head and say where examples of state capture have occurred and how they occurred, and you'll find it's the leadership that have caused the capture of all public sector organisations to the extent, as Daniela said, where the real life consequences are absolutely stark. I'm just in South Africa at the moment, and there's been the whole Zondo Commission that's been done looking at the state capture of state-owned enterprises and then the loss to GDP, as well as, you know, infrastructure losses that they're still struggling to recover from that happened in just a few years. I think that the two elements I always think about leadership, because of the public sector, is unique in that sense. The one is the technical administrative leadership of the people employed, but there's also political leadership. And the political leadership and the political override is just as much at risk as the administrative override and executive override. So you have to have real, and it's, this comes back to what I was saying at the outset about we're at a point now where people are losing faith and trust and believe that people are enriching themselves everywhere. And there is cronyism, and there is absolutely third parties like consultants and others benefiting from this whole system. And to have the upstanding moral leadership that can be trusted with a proper moral framework. And this is where we have to talk about things that aren't traditionally, we see business as objective or government or the workers objective, but there's actually a cultural and moral aspect to this at the end of the day. And that's what the leadership needs to bring. So you don't just employ someone because they're technocratically good or they're good at managing people. They have to have integrity, and there has to be a mechanism where that's got to start becoming considered in the recruitment and the retention of leaders. Because we are trying to make this non-personal or non-even emotional and ethical, and that's not right. And that's why I think we have a crisis now of leadership. And the consequence of that is, one of the worst consequences is the proliferation of corruption when it's not getting better. And so the leadership absolutely, as I said again, is pivotal. There's no way around it. If you can't work around it if it's not there.
And Daniela, how has leadership engagement impacted the success of anti-corruption strategies in your work?
In my work, leadership is at the core of any type of engagement we have. In the office in UNODC, we work with committed leaders because we can only go and conduct the corruption risk management process in organizations that have asked our support and where leadership commitment is there. And this, of course, has allowed us to achieve like a small change, but also bigger change. But in the long run, it has also made organizations more efficient. And something that is very important, it has also increased employee satisfaction, because then people working in the organizations see the commitment from their leaders to openly talk about corruption risks and to say, okay, what can be changed, what can be done, and how can we make our institution stronger? So that really encourages a lot of people to understand why they are there and why their work is important and how their work can contribute to something better. And this is key, that leaders show this commitment, and that in the long run generates this very dynamic or more open discussion within the organizations. And that's key to make them work. We cannot just pretend that everything is working perfectly and there's no corruption risks, but corruption risks exist everywhere, exist in my own office, in every office of the world. They are there, and we have to start talking about that openly, because corruption risks are natural. We cannot avoid them. We are not perfect. We cannot make perfect systems, perfect processes. And that's the message that we need also leaders to take to their own staff and to clearly explain to them that the corruption risk management process is not a witch hunt, and we are not trying to find who is a culprit here, but rather make the institution stronger. And also, of course, for leaders, it is key that they also understand that this is a long-term process. And sometimes leaders, of course, need to have some short-term gains, because we know how things work in the public sector. We need citizens. We all want to see changes now, but we also need to think about the future. And the beauty of this process is that it offers both to leaders the opportunity to have like short-term gains, but also gains in the medium and in the long run. And also, of course, we have to talk about the political gains leaders can gain from fostering these processes into the organizations. It is just a big sign to anyone that leaders decide to take this process forward in their organization, because it really shows a determination to prevent corruption and not just to make nice statements about how they want to prevent corruption, but rather taking action.
Absolutely. And Khalid, can you give our listeners a brief overview of CIPFA's corruption prevention program? I know that we've recently launched the second pilot in Mauritius. What makes this program stand out?
So just to give a little overview, first of all, the premise on which the program was developed, and this was in discussions with Daniela and her colleagues in UNODC, where the fundamental premise was corruption prevention has got to be cultural as well as technical. It's not just another example of a dashboard of technocratic issues. You've got to understand this is a live thing that needs to be brought to people's attention. And as Daniela said, it's about talking about the issue and not making it a taboo, breaking the taboo, if you like. The second issue was change what you can. There's grand corruption, there's petty corruption, but ultimately people have got to feel empowered. So you've got to change what's possible to change. So small stuff is just as important as the big stuff. And it's that concept of having power to do something that's really important. Third element is, because of that, it's as much bottom up. Quite often we get these top down processes from the organization, but you actually need people in the organization themselves to want it to happen and create that groundswell, which has the support and the sponsorship from leadership we talked about, but has to come from the bottom up. And the final thing, which is a refrain I hear often from my colleagues in UNODC, is keep it simple. You know, you overcomplicate, you over-engineer it, you create space for consultants to make money, but you're not making a difference. And I think this is kind of what the program's trying to do. So what we do is we have an education aspect where we're teaching about the premise of the basis of anti-corruption and corruption prevention and types of corruption. We then try and have a practical element where people actually go and do an assessment, and we then get people together and say, so what do you do? And pick one or two of those elements and see if you can do something about them, the simple ones. And then finally, we want outward facing exposure of institutions to say, yes, we're preventing corruption and we're committing to it and we're committing resources to it. So therefore, it's not just on somebody's initiative, it's actually institutionalized in the organization. So this is what we're trying. Traditionally across the world, and Daniela will obviously attest to this, it's a very difficult subject to conquer and to tackle. There's probably more things that have not worked than have worked. So we're not saying that our program is going to work, but that's what we're saying. We want to evaluate it, and where it doesn't work, we need to look at it rather than say this is wonderful, it's perfect. I don't think we're going to stop corruption somehow, but what we're trying to do is at least again bring more light to the process and to the conversation and have more information. The final thing I would say is people are very good at being trained and they like being trained, but they're not as open about showing what they're doing in their organizations. And so this is why it's important that we actually see the reality and not just go into the classroom and teach people. So that's kind of what the basis of the program is.
And looking ahead, what are the main challenges for corruption prevention and corruption risk management? And how can these approaches shape the future of public finance? So two big questions here. Daniela, I'll start with you and then Khalid, feel free to jump in.
Thank you, Jess. Yeah, I think one of the key challenges for the corruption risk management process overall is the need to scale up this process. We've been talking about how preventing corruption is so important, and here we have a tool that could allow us to implement, to really achieve change, and that's what we all want, to have some impact. But in order to have that change, so far in UNODC, we've been working with specific authorities in specific countries. And then that's why we partner with CIPFA in order to have more hands to do this work and to train more people. So hopefully the countries will take the task of scaling this work up, meaning that taking this to the national level to have maybe some sort of national regulations that make sure that the process is not only implemented in certain organizations, but also at the national, at the regional, at the local level. So that would be, in an ideal world, what would happen. Every organization would be conducting the corruption risk management process and, of course, implementing the mitigation strategies they develop. And for that, the second challenge would be the commitment that has to come from the leaders of these organizations. Not all leaders are the same. Not all leaders are committed. And that's why this is a challenge. But we hope that there's a learning by example experience within the countries where we have had good experiences, like some of the ones I've told you. With examples, leaders can see that really the process allows them to make the organization better and more efficient. And at the end of the day, to use the public resources in a better way. And the third challenge I see is that we need to find a way, and here maybe Khalid has some ideas, in how to make this process part of the yearly strategic planning that already happens in every country. How do we align this process or attach this process really to the national planning and also make sure that there's enough budget in the countries to implement these mitigation plans? Because we do not want to have more nice looking papers, but we want to implement the work, and the implementation comes hand in hand with a budget and human resources for that, not only the budget, but also the human resources. So this planning would have to include budget and who within the organizations and how this process can be implemented and monitored and evaluated, of course.
And Khalid, I'll turn to you now. What do you think are the main challenges?
To build on what Danielle said, and I'm glad you asked her first and not me. But to build on what she's Danielle said, there are two things I would add. And one is an enhancement, exactly the last point that Danielle referred to, is the integration into the public financial management process. And actually, CIPFA has PF in its name, public finance, and that PF is fundamental. And at the moment, it's like a blind spot corruption sometimes. It's not brought into that process and integrated into it in a way which is given prominence. So you've got the budget process, you've got the accounting process, you've got the reporting process, you've got the procurement processes all integrated into the public finance. But the actual assessment of corruption and corruption prevention is not baked in, and it needs to be integrated. And I think part of the reason, which is the other challenge of why that's happened, so you've got to understand why is that not happening when we know that corruption is destroying so much and the extent of it is so broad. Why is it not happening? Well, I think there are one of the reasons why it's not happening, which is the other challenge, is it falls between different professions. So you have law enforcement, you have the legal profession, you have the budget holders, you have the accountants, you have the internal auditors, you have the external auditors, but no one directly is responsible for this area in their space. So what happens is I see it as an auditor and I see an internal control failure. You see it as a lawyer, you see a breach of law. And so people are looking at the same thing, but they're calling it different things. So what we need to also do is get that common understanding amongst different specialists and professionals so that we can create an understanding where we're all looking at the thing in the same way and have the same view of it. And that will then help the public finance space in terms of bringing it into this, as Daniela correctly says, everyday thinking, not just an afterthought, but actually integrating it. I mean, at the end of the day, if I've got £1 million or $1 million to implement something, but I'm losing 200,000 through corruption, I can't achieve my objective. And so ultimately, this is absolutely destroying all the things that may be good and stopping us achieving. And we talked about, you know, things like climate change and climate adaptation right now, and the amounts of money that are going to be spent over the next decade, trillions of dollars. And that could be all undermined with this if we don't deal with this issue in a way that's intelligent. So it's, again, it's that integrated thinking amongst different disciplines and across different disciplines. I think that's at the heart of the challenge. I don't know if Daniel has got any views on that.
I completely agree with you, Khalid. I think you have, we complement each other in what we have been seeing. I think something I would add is to all of this is that at the end of the day, we have to remain hopeful and that most public officials are good public officials. And that's something we also have to start changing, because corruption, sometimes the news and all the information we receive makes us think that most people are corrupt. And that's not really the case, because public officials do face a lot of struggles. And we have to be grateful that some of us decide to go to the public sector and work there and give their best and being in there, me, myself, that I've been there. It is difficult and it's challenging, and we have to be hopeful that leaders, and here I stress the role of leaders is so important, because we do have some public officials that are very committed and they really need the push from leaders to change things in the institutions. And that's why it's so important that we now are having this discussion, and hopefully some people listening in can also start looking or thinking a bit more into corruption prevention more than into chasing criminals, which is also important. But let's also try to find ways in which we can make institutions stronger. And I would like to also, I don't have a quote as I was saying, Khalid, but I do have a book recommendation that is called Humankind. That is a hopeful story. It's from Rutger Bergman. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but it's like a very nice book where he talks about how we need to also change our chip and seeing that there is kindness in many situations in our everyday life, in everything we do. And sometimes when we talk about corruption, everything is gray, but there's light, because there are so many people out there, as I said, fighting to have better institutions and to make things work for everyone. And yeah, I think I don't have anything to add.
Thank you, Daniela. Thank you, Khalid. And thank you for that book recommendation. I'll be sure to link for our listeners. Khalid and Daniela, thank you for sharing your thoughts on today's episode of Sit for Speaks. For those listening, make sure to follow us on social media for more and never miss another episode. Previous episodes can be found on Sitfor's website or wherever you like to listen to podcasts. We'll be back next month. Until then, goodbye.